Beginning on February 17th, there have been a series of talks on the theme, how do you want to live? And the theme comes out of the realization that our society, our lives, are being significantly impacted by any number of events, in terms of the pandemic, in terms of social issues, environmental issues, now war, rumors of war, so to speak. So these are stressful times, but they also can prompt a reevaluation and reconstruction of value in one's life. Now, as I said several times during this series, talking about different topics, as a mental health professional, it's well known that when a person intentionally changes their life routine, that is much less stressful and much more likely to be successful than if a person is forced to change while they're resisting, fighting it. So one of the metaphors that I've used over the years is the ability of some trees to survive a storm, whereas others get broken. And as I say this, I'm recalling, I made a trip to a workshop in North Carolina many years ago. And this was right after a significant hurricane came up the east coast of Florida and slammed into South Carolina and moved on up into North Carolina. And so I was driving up there, and as I left, I guess, I-95 and started heading northwest across Carolinas, evidence of the storm was there. And it was like a giant lawnmower had moved along the pathway of the road and just chopped all these trees off. I mean, it went on for miles and miles and miles, and they were just snapped off, you know, from being uprooted to 6 or 7 feet off the ground. But maybe 5-10% of the trees were still standing. And a lot of them were bent over or otherwise impacted. So that really impacted me. It's a metaphor for adaptation to stormy weather, if you will. Learning how to bend rather than break. So that has been a theme of my life ever since then. I was just starting my meditation career then. And so that's the kind of intention or orientation that I want to bring to these discussions. Tonight's topic is about mindfulness in a healthy body. This is actually the last of the series. Talks about how do you want to live. You know, of course, we are all being affected by life's travails. When you buy a body, vulnerability to illness and injury and aging comes with the package. So that's a given. But how do we adapt? How do we mitigate the effects of aging? I'm 75 years old, so I've certainly been contemplating this for many, many years. Issue of skillfully managing physical health and well-being goes beyond, you know, your individual issues. One of the things that's become evident over the last several years as the baby boom generation gets older, and I'm certainly one of the first baby boomers. I was born 9 months and 2 days after they signed the armistice with Japan, Tokyo Bay. So I think I can qualify as being one of the very first of the baby boomers. But as the baby boomers have gotten older, they're putting stress on the whole healthcare system. System in terms of doctors, medical professionals, nurses, so forth and so on. And one of the things that's been reported widely is the degree of burnout among health professionals during the course of the pandemic. It's just been absolutely unrelenting, very stressful. And it's also putting great stress on health insurance companies and perhaps the biggest health insurance company, which is Medicare, Medicaid. And it's been clear that systems are heading for bankruptcy. And one of the considered factors in this is people have not been proactive in taking care of themselves. You know, obesity is epidemic in this culture. People live very lethargic lifestyles and live on junk food and are deprived of sleep because of late night TV, internet. So these are all issues that are going to become more and more impactful over time. Now, I'm part of that generation, and I've been confronted with some of these concerns. In 1999, I had a sinus infection that just would not go away, despite various antibiotics and so forth and so on. Finally, the physician took a blood sample and said, "Oh my God, your blood sugar is over 200. You have diabetes. I never would have thought that because you're such a slender fellow." And I heard, well, my father had diabetes and he actually died. He said, seldom die from diabetes, type 2 diabetes, from the side effects. So despite being reasonably fit and eating well and so forth and so on, I had diabetes. The woman told me, "You're going to have a hard time with this because you're so slender." And I said to myself, "Lady, you have no idea who you're talking to." And I went from the doctor's office to the Borders bookstore, which existed back then, and bought several books on type 2 diabetes and went home and read them and did research online. And then a month or so, my blood sugar was back to what it would be if I wasn't diabetic, with the support of medication and so forth and so on. And it's been normal ever since then, still being supported by medication. So when I was saying you have no idea who you're talking to, I knew the discipline that I had gained from my meditation practice. In 1999, I started practicing in 1986. So I've been meditating for many years at that time. Kind of self-awareness and self-discipline really paid off. And so I've had medical problems since then. You know, I've had to have cataract surgery. I had a torn muscle in my left shoulder. I had that repaired. And other medical events but not really avoidable. I could have avoided the injury in my shoulder, I suppose, but you know, I was training to be physically fit during the muscle up there. But the point I'm trying to make here is that I had been proactive in terms of my health even before I was diagnosed with diabetes. My meditation practice has helped with that. And I believe that, you know, I have saved myself and the insurance industry money as a result of that. And I'm hoping that other people will be similarly inspired to be proactive in terms of healthcare. So what I want to talk about with this tonight, with this topic, is how regular practice of mindfulness of breathing, loving kindness meditation, body scanning, so forth and so on, is really, really beneficial medically. There's been a lot of research. It began right after World War II, studying Zen monks in Japan. And it's gotten more and more sophisticated over the decades since then. Not just with mindfulness, although mindfulness is probably the most rigorously researched of the disciplines, but also there's been research regarding Zen meditation, transcendental meditation, Hatha yoga, Tai Chi. There are a lot of benefits from contemplative practice. There's probably been research in terms of Christian prayer. I'm not aware of it. It's been, not been an area of research for me. So, as I mentioned a minute ago, research began right after World War II, when there were a lot of American servicemen and medical professionals in Japan. And they were practicing with Zen monks and using various devices to measure heart rate and conductivity of the skin, which indicates levels of stress in the body, and devices to measure contraction in the muscles. So these devices became more widely used in terms of what were called lie detectors. Ask people questions, they stress out if they've lied, supposedly, and get to the truth. However, one of the things they did discover, even early on, is that a very well-trained Buddhist monk could pass a lie detector test with flying colors, although they committed to not lying. Of course, it's one of the five precepts, because they trained themselves to be non-reactive to stress. So then in the 1990s, research became much more sophisticated, the use of computers. I've mentioned before a book that I read that was written, I think last year, maybe the year before last, called Altered Traits, by Richard Davidson and Daniel Goleman. And it really tracks the development of neuroscientific research, strongly influenced by suggestions by the Dalai Lama, who's very, very interested in science, Western science, even as a boy before he was forced to be Chinese communist in Tibet. So they started to investigate not just those indicators, which, you know, blood pressure and heart rate and muscle tension and skin conductivity. They started to apply that into something that's called biofeedback, which was being used by professionals to help people to learn how to manage anxiety, stress. Then they came along with functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, which can actually show where blood is flowing in the brain which shows which parts of the brain are operating in different tasks. And cephalographs, EEGs, which can track the frequency and amplitude of electrochemical processes in the brain. So they started to really understand how the brain works. And also, more sophisticated in understanding the interactions between the brain and the physiology in the body. And this is where it pertains to physical health. So, major area of research is inflammation. I was just reading an article today in the New York Times about inflammation and anxiety, inflammation and depression. This woman was doing her PhD work up in Canada. Her research involved exercise and anxiety, but also eventually led to exercise and depression. And she realized with her research that there's a particular set of hormones, I'm not listing them in my notes, but they are indicators of stress and of inflammation. And there's an association between the saturation of these hormones in the body and the symptoms of depression and anxiety. And the more a person is physically active, the less inflammation there is in the body. And the symptoms of depression and anxiety are diminished. And she said, this is true up to a point. If a person goes overboard with their physical exercise, the effects are not good. Really harms the body. This leads to another hormone that's more researched that I've talked about before. It's cortisol. Whenever we are stressed, body starts to send cortisol out. The brain signals the body to create cortisol and send it out through the bloodstream. And this helps in the fight or flight process. Allows people to function under extreme duress, not feel pain, be able to function despite severe injury until the immediate threat is gone, at which point it collapses. So cortisol in the short term is very important for survival. However, when people are chronically stressed, cortisol has a deleterious effect on the body, and one of the main ways that it does that is through inflammation. Inflammation, you can recognize what happens when you get a bruise, and it gets red, and then purple, and so forth, and so on. That's inflammation. When your sinuses get clogged up, from allergies, that's inflammation. But also inflammation affects the arteries. This can lead to hardening of the arteries, arteriosclerosis, which is associated with heart disease and with strokes. So inflammation is very, very significant issue in one's life. Effects of inflammation can also be associated with problems of cancer, or in multiple sclerosis, other kinds of diseases that are associated with, well, they may not be caused by stress, but they're aggravated by stress. Another is irritable bowel syndrome, fibromyalgia, and even arthritis. It can all be aggravated. Now, people take anti-inflammatory medications over the counter, you know, aspirin, ibuprofen, naproxen, so forth and so on. Naproxen is a lead. And that could be helpful, but it does not address the underlying problems of stress. What causes the stress? Causes the inflammation. There's also chronic pain. People who have injuries that are caused by traffic accidents, combat, so forth and so on. These injuries are debilitating and people are prescribed pain medication. That's one of the issues that's become really predominant in the last couple of years is opioid addiction, fentanyl, so forth and so on. Now, people who are genuinely in chronic, deep chronic pain, like people who are dying from cancer, they can't become addicted to opiates. Opiates are truly beneficial in that regard. My mother died of cancer. My wife and I took care of her in her last months. She died in her home. And we would give her several doses of opiates every day. She was not, we could tell that she needed another dose because she would start writhing in pain. Died. The research indicates that a person who is really in pain can't become addicted to opiates. But the problem is that people who do not have adequate stress management skills tend to subjectively exaggerate their pain. In other words, let's say that someone has some spasm in the muscles or some injury to a muscle. What happens is when they start to become psychologically stimulated by that, then other muscles elsewhere in the body become contracted and other processes in the body become affected. And so there's a ripple effect and the pain seems to be worse. And this was known in the 1970s. And a fellow named John Kabat-Zinn, who was actually a friend, is a friend of Richard Davidson and Daniel Goleman. They all went to college together. They all started practicing mindfulness meditation together back in the 1960s. And John Kabat-Zinn wanted to apply what he had learned from his meditation practice and yoga practice to people with chronic pain and other disabling diseases that were aggravated by stress, by inflammation. So he started something called mindfulness-based stress reduction, often term MBSR is applied. I read about this in a book called Healing in the Mind by Bill Moyers. And it was a TV documentary as well. I think this was in the early 1980s. No, late 1980s, after I had become a psychotherapist. And I actually called John Kabat-Zinn, who was, his work was at the University of Massachusetts Teaching Hospital in Worcester, Massachusetts. I called him and said, I wanted to learn how to do this. And he said, the only way you're going to be successful at this is if you're associated with a teaching hospital. Well, years went by. MBSR is now everywhere in the world. This got started. He wanted to apply, you know, mindfulness strategies and yoga practices and group therapy support, which is another way to mitigate the effects of inflammation and stress. So he went to the doctors who were dealing with people with chronic pain and multiple sclerosis and irritable bowel syndrome and so forth and so on. at the teaching hospital in Worcester and said, let me work with the people who can be able to help. I said, okay, sure, go ahead and do this. So he did and had some success. He created an 8-week program, which still exists to this day, that people during which people learn how to meditate and do mild yogic exercises that are appropriate for their circumstances. And it was discovered that the amount of pain medication that a person was taking was significantly dropped because they learned how to manage their pain more skillfully. It's what's called the focal pain. And then there's what's called referred pain. And I alluded to it a few minutes ago. Focal pain is where the actual injury is. Referred pain is the pain that comes from elsewhere in the body that has become aggravated or inflamed due to psychological stress. So MBSR is probably one of the most well-researched modalities for treating people with chronic disabling pain and other difficulties. It's not a cure. It's a way to mitigate the effects of stress. That's something that's really important to consider in terms of the benefits of meditation. Now, one of the things that we know from the research is in the brain, the areas that signal distress and confusion, the amygdala and the hippocampus, strongly associated with areas in the brain, like the nucleus accumbens, that initiates behavioral responses to stimuli. And when a person is really stressed out, the responses are of inflammation. And so what happens in the brain when you practice mindfulness breathing meditation or loving kindness meditation, and you notice how the mind is reacting to something uncomfortable in the body, something as simple as an itch. I can assure you that if you have an itch and you start to grapple with it, there will be tension elsewhere in the body. However, when you encounter the unpleasant feeling of the itch, the impulsive reactivity, and instead of grappling with it, you accept it. You soften the mind's interaction with that unpleasant physical sensation. The referred pain tends to diminish significantly. Something important to consider in terms of managing pain. The other thing that's important about this in terms of people who have disabilities, impaired movement, that it's valuable to be very mindful of how you move your body. You have lost use of, like, you have to be very mindful about how you move. You have chronic pain in the shoulder, for example. You have to be very mindful about how you use that arm. And I know this from my rehab, from the surgery I had on my left shoulder. And also, you know, the rehab was quite painful. And I was able to effectively manage that pain from rotating the arm and stretching the tight muscles much more effectively. And the therapist, occupational therapist who worked with me, was impressed. He said, wow, you're really making progress with this. And I attributed a lot of it to my ability to manage how I move my body and how I manage pain. So that's an important part of this, is to be mindful of movement. Also, in terms of well-being, health, been a lot of research on how difficult it is for people who are obese or who have diabetes or other metabolic problems to maintain an effective intervention. That's why I was talking to that doctor when I was diagnosed with diabetes. As soon as I knew what I had to do, I didn't have to do a whole lot with my diet because I've not been that caught up with what are called the hyperglycemic foods. But I had the discipline to take care of myself, take care of my body. So there's been a lot of research about how effective mindfulness meditation can be in terms of people in weight management programs and dealing with diabetes in terms of what to eat, what not to eat, how much to eat, taking medication, so forth and so on. So this practice of using mindfulness to effectively intervene in these medical conditions is very important. Now, I want to put it in the context of other issues that can be that have been researched. There's been research that suggests that regular mindfulness meditation, people who've been doing it for a long time, are less affected by normal processes of aging, which are associated with inflammation. There are little caps on the end of each DNA molecule called telomeres. It's sort of like the ends you see on in shoelaces. But the function of telomeres is to maintain the integrity of the DNA when the DNA is being replicated, which happens, you know, all the time, everybody's body. The telomeres kind of come apart, the DNA spiral splits and replicated and then reproduced, and the telomeres reform. But one of the things that happens with inflammation is that the effective replacement of the telomeres is degraded, diminished. And those of us who've had shoes for a long time, you know that the little caps on the end start to wear out. Then you got these little fuzzy ends to the shoelaces. Well, that's strongly suggested to be a cause of some of the degenerative problems that are associated with aging. Cognitive decline, other problems might even be associated with arthritis and so forth and so on. And also, the research suggests that people who regularly meditate have stronger immune systems than would otherwise be indicated. It's in Madison, Wisconsin, where Richie Davidson is, has a large research center. They invited college students to come in for research on the production of antibodies. So they gave these students flu shots. They had them give blood samples before the flu shot. They had a control group and they had a study group. Control group got the flu shots, were asked to come back in a few weeks because they wanted to measure the effectiveness of the flu vaccine creating antibodies that would prevent getting the flu or would significantly diminish the effects of, you know, the deleterious effects of the flu virus. The study group were people who were committed mindfulness meditators. already had been meditating. So these weren't college students. They were folks like me. Gave him flu shots, gave a blood sample before, gave a blood sample afterwards. It was discovered that people who were meditators had significantly higher saturation of antibodies than the control group did. So there's research that suggests that dedicated mindfulness meditation practice, because of the way it affects hormonal production and stress reactivity in the brain and how that radiates out into the body, improves one's immune function. So this is a very important research. So I wanted to share this information with you all about how important it is to train your mind to be less stress reactive and to be more self-aware and more self-disciplined, less impulsively reactive. The health benefits that it has and how important that is, not just for your future, but the social functioning in this country and in the world. Because there's going to be a crisis in the medical community. Right now they're saying there probably won't be enough doctors in a decade or so. And because people retire or burning out. And if more and more people are getting ill, and there are fewer and fewer doctors, that's going to be very disruptive. Not just because people are ill, but also because it's going to impact the productivity of the population. People walking around who are in pain and sick because they're not taking care of themselves physically. I was also reading an article about burnout in physicians, and the report showed that a very significant number of doctors, medical doctors, show symptoms of anxiety and depression, but dare not report it. They cannot report that they're having these stress reactive problems, because if they do, then they will be, their license will be threatened. Their medical license will be threatened. I actually had two or three medical practitioners, doctors and nurses, who came to see me to meet the requirements of their licensing board, so that it was on record that they were getting help for their stress. And of course, I wanted them to practice mindfulness meditation because I was aware of this research. So this is what I have to share about the benefits of regular mindfulness meditation in terms of a person's physical well-being, but also in terms of the functionality of our society. So not a long talk tonight as is usual, but we do have time for questions or comments about what you heard me say. Bob?
Peter, I have a question. What's your definition of people who meditate in regard to health? And what I'm thinking of there is, you know, nowadays you can have these meditation apps for 5 minutes, for 10 minutes, with music, with all kinds of stuff. So is there a direct correlation between the amount of meditation and the benefits, the health benefits of meditation?
Very good question. I don't know of any research that specifically targets that. I am very skeptical that 5 minutes of a guided meditation with pretty music has a significant impact on a person's stress reactivity. the degree of inflammation in the body.
Yeah.
All the times I've been on retreats, the recommended minimum practice was daily practice, 45 minutes.
Okay.
You could make an analogy to someone who wanted to be competent in any kind of craft, whether it's musicianship or being athletic, being a dancer or singer. Do you think that 5 minutes of practice is going to help you to learn to play the piano? No.
Mm-hmm.
You need to practice for probably a couple of hours a day, probably every day, to have any kind of proficiency. So as far as I'm concerned, this is a skill set. It's not mystical in that regard. So I don't know what we could call the turning point, wherein you could say, okay, if a person does 17 minutes and 30 seconds of meditation, and it is proscribed. In other words, you know the person's meditating because there's some kind of telemetric readout that shows that they are actually hitting the target and doing it. I don't know of any research in that regard. So it's very subjective. But I do know from my own experience and what I've heard from my students over the decades that they notice a difference. And I really believe that my functioning has been significantly enhanced psychologically as well as physically because of my 40-year career practicing mindfulness meditation than it would have been otherwise. And especially in terms of my physical health, I had the discipline to get regular exercise. I had the discipline to manage what I eat. I have the discipline to continue to take the medication that is prescribed. I take several anti-inflammatory supplements, fish oil, other anti-inflammatories, because I've done the research and I have the discipline to follow through on it. So that's what I have to say about that. I don't know how they could do a really rigorous study on what the minimum requirement for efficacy is.
Yeah. Okay.
Kevin.
Peter, go back 5 minutes. I remember that. That was what was required in the workshop that I attended with you. And I did maintain that for some time. Unfortunately, not anymore. But my question related to this is 45 minutes that based on practice, that seems to be the effect. Have you read anything about, you know, why 45 versus 30 versus 60?
No. It's just what I was told by the teachers on the retreats that I've been on. And that's why I suggested. I do believe that if a person meditated on a daily basis 30 minutes, there would be a benefit. But I think that there would not be any advancement, any improvement on those benefits until you sat for longer periods of time. And I do believe that, I mean, it just imagine like any skill. If you want to be good at playing the piano, you got to practice. You know, if you want to be able to run a half marathon, you cannot wait until the day of the marathon to do it. You might not even be able to walk the distance of a half marathon without some kind of daily training. So it's analogous to that. I think there's a direct comparison there. The more you're willing to, in a disciplined way, not just sit there and space out for 45 minutes, but really apply yourself to the meditation practice, just like you would really apply yourself to playing the scales on the piano. That's how you get better at it. And it literally changes the brain, the way the brain is structured. And that changes how the physiology of the body operates. That's pretty well researched now.
That's the
ultradian rhythm.
Oh,
yeah, there's a research that's done on what's called the ultradian rhythm, and it's the assumption is that our levels of sympathetic and parasympathetic activities in the body operate on about a 90-minute schedule, so that there are 90 minutes of being more active and alert, but there are 90 minutes of not being so active and alert. And that goes on throughout the day. The circadian rhythm has to do with sleep and wake cycle. But I don't know of any research that's been done that is relevant to benefits in terms of either the ultradian rhythm or the circadian cycle.
It's just interesting that 45 minutes is half of that cycle.
Well, I've routinely sat for 90 minutes. So you could say it's a whole cycle.
Yeah.
And I actually routinely sat for 2 hours. So I don't know what that was about the ultradian rhythm right there. But, I don't know how you would do that research. Once again, it's so subtle, so sophisticated. How do you tell whether the subject is actually performing as required, and how can you tell what the effect actually is with any degree of validity? Those are two confounding issues. Other questions or comments?
I think it would be easier than you think to measure that, because when you're sitting, you're consciously accompanying your mind with breathing. Like you say, practicing a piano, you are intentionally doing that to meditate. And I think the body gets used to slowing down when you get good at competing with the mind's thinking, and the thinking slows. That's what being still is about, or stillness. Because if you do sit consistently, you will experience stillness in the thinking, but you still have to maintain the breathing. And the minute you forget that, you'll fall asleep. You'll pick up things in yourself. Like occasionally when I miss a sit on a day, I'm more agitated than normal. But I find myself on the breath doing everything, washing dishes, driving, and I found that to be quite a soothing response. And then when Peter talked about it tonight, and he's talked about it before, it's reinforcing to know that, that consistency pays off.
One of the major criticisms of this kind of research, John, is that it can't be quantified.
But if you and that's oxygen the content of the brain when you're sitting, and that's what they did to those Zen monks versus non-sitters.
That still doesn't track the subjectivity. The closest that you could get to that is through what's called neurofeedback. If you give someone a task and the EEG or the fMRI functioning is linked to that, and you can tell by looking on a screen whether that person is performing on task, then you can measure that. But that still does not really, at this point, provide enough quantification, enough numbers in the way that science requires. I will say, though, that MBSR is considered to be a research-based modality. That's one of the things that's really big in the world of psychology and medical practice as well. But is it been supported by research. For example, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is considered to be a research-based psychotherapy modality because there's some degree of rigor that can be applied there, but it still doesn't have the kind of in-depth or quantifiable results that you can compare one person's episode with another person's episode with another person's episode. That's why you have to have a large number of people in a study to get any kind of meaningful results. But how do you compare one subject to another subject to another subject to another subject when it comes to one's subjective experience? Very, very difficult. Well, so far,
if you measure the oxygen being used with a meditator and a non-meditator versus their blood pressure and their heart rate, you would very clearly see the one who is calmer. And that, I believe, is the consistency that could be measured that would be able to...
Right, but that only associates with oxygen, and it might be able to link it up to oxidation in the nervous system, in the bloodstream or whatever. That's the problem, see? It's one of the things that's been a criticism of neuroscientific research of mindfulness meditation, because it does not meet the rigor of other modalities. I agree with you, John. I know that it's effective.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying this is what gravity on you. They measured in astronauts, and I'm saying applying those measurements would show clearly, in my opinion, given they've done it in terms of gravity, the oxygen use, blood pressure, heart rate, all those sort of five things electronically are watched. I'm sure you would very clearly see the distinction between a meditator and a non-meditator.
Right. But you and I can agree on that, but I don't know who in the National Academy of Sciences would necessarily do so.
Another one is further complicated by the complexity and the cost of the technology.
Yes.
And its lack of portability.
Yes. Other questions or comments before we wrap it up for the evening? All right, so next week is uncertain what the presentation is going to be. Andy Quinn, some of you know Andy, he's the founding teacher of the Lakeland Meditation Community. He's just completing tomorrow a 30-day retreat at the Forest Refuge up in Massachusetts. I left a message on his voicemail asking him if he would be willing to be the guest speaker next week to talk about his retreat experience, which is something we do routinely here when someone's been on a significant retreat, then to come and think out loud. Now, Andy wouldn't be here. It would be doing it via Zoom, I assume. So that's a possibility. If not, then I'm going to start to talk about the Four Noble Truths, and particularly about dukkha. Dive into the whole issue of what dukkha is from a neuroscientific perspective, as well as the traditional Buddhist rendering. So let's sit for a moment. I wish you well, folks. Hope you all have a safe and pleasant week till next time we talk.